Andrew Ferguson, I should tell all who are listening, particularly if they're not regular readers of the Weekly Standard, is one of the most interesting commentators on public affairs and social issues, and also one of the funniest. He's not there to be funny. He's there to illuminate and to analyze in depth. But that always becomes easier if you can kid around with it a little bit. And you've been doing that beautifully.
Well, one hopes it keeps them reading if you can make them laugh once in a while.
Keeps me reading.
Yeah.
Keeps me reading and very much enjoying your columns, your articles in the Weekly Standard, which I take to be one of the most influential, one of the most interesting, dare we call it, conservative journals in the country.
Well, I think that it is definitely a conservative journal that has a wide range ideologically, even so. And we're quite proud of our Catholic small c range of views that and writers that we have.
And as they say in the magazine trade, the back of the book, meaning the section of with book reviews and arts articles and so on, is terribly literate without being painful.
Yes, absolutely. We try to strike just the right note between pedantry and pop.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we don't want the articles to be so obscure that no one can follow them unless you have a PhD. But at the same time, we don't want people to read them and just kind of toss the magazine.
But reading your many pieces, as I've done always with enjoyment, I see there's a Ferguson piece. I will go to it first. I somehow had not heard until just a few months ago that you had done a new book titled Land of Lincoln, Adventures in Abe's America. That comes from your own, or it originates, as we learn in your preface, in your own childhood investment, enthusiasm, virtual identification with, if not with Lincoln, at least with those who knew Lincoln to be the great and central American hero.
Yes, absolutely. I was a buff from the very beginning, a Lincoln buff. In fact, I grew up out in Hinsdale in the western suburbs and in a house on Lincoln Street, about half a mile from a house where it was rumored Abraham Lincoln had once spent the night in the 1850s. My father was a partner at Isham, Lincoln & Beale, the law firm founded by Robert Todd Lincoln, who was Lincoln's only surviving son. So I kind of had Lincoln coming out the ears, and I liked it, though. When I was old enough to remember, my parents took me down to Springfield so to see the sights down there, or the Lincoln Shrines, as they were then mm-hmm. known. We went out to New Salem, and to me it was a way of sort of learning about the history of the country that was filled with personality and drama, and I was intoxicated by it.
Was the conception for this book generated by that event in Richmond where they were about to put up a statue of Lincoln and lots of people got very angry?
Well, it was, yeah, this was the precipitating event, I'd say. I picked up my local newspaper, the Washington Post, one morning about 3 or 4 years ago, and saw a headline that said, Lincoln's statue stirs outrage in Richmond. And, you know, Lincoln and outrage are just sort of two words you don't expect to see in the same sentence. But sure enough, the city fathers of Richmond, Virginia, had made a decision to install a statue of Abraham Lincoln and his son Tad on public property down there. And, of course, it's the capital of the Confederacy. And I think the city fathers were quite taken aback to discover that there were still a lot of Confederates around. I don't know why they should have been shocked by that.
What's the distance by land miles between Washington and Richmond?
Almost exactly 100 miles. I think it's 99.5 miles.
It's always seemed to me rather startling.
Yeah.
And rather confusing that they would have put the Confederate capital that close to Washington.
Right. Well, they started with it in Birmingham, Alabama.
Yeah.
But I think they thought it was more manly to have it right outside Washington in a kind of taunting sort of way. And, you know, their descendants are still there, these very sort of manly, obstreperous guys. And I went down and spent a lot of time with them. And a couple of things happened that I wasn't expecting to see. One was the Lincoln haters, as I came to call them, put on a scholarly conference to kind of amplify on the reasons that they disliked Lincoln. In response, the people who were putting in the statue had a scholarly conference in which they would defend Lincoln's honor. And the interesting thing was that the people who at the anti-Lincoln conference were actually much more impressive in a sort of scholarly and historical way. They seem to know more and have points that were better articulated than the people at the pro-Lincoln conference.
Well, what were their points? If you're going to be a serious Lincoln hater, what do you tend to focus upon?
Well, you know, there was a great poster that was for sale at the anti-Lincoln conference that said, you think all our problems began in the 60s, you're right, the 1860s. And these guys traced back to the Civil War, and especially to Lincoln's handling of the Civil War, all of the things that they disliked about contemporary America. Big government, big business, the dissolution of family ties, the weakening of sort of cultural formalities and norms. And it was the things that they disliked about the country were to them personified in Lincoln. So to the extent that they disliked the turn that the country had taken over the last, well, take your pick, 20 years or 120 years, they blamed Lincoln for it.
In your journey around the country, and we're going to talk about many of the stops that you made, I think you did not stop particularly in Rockford, Illinois, did you?
No, I didn't.
There you will find a bunch of Lincoln haters, or at least the Lincoln demeanors, up there as well. You're nodding, so you know what I'm talking about.
Sure. There's a magazine there.
Chronicles.
The Chronicles of Culture is what it used to be called. I think it's just called Chronicles now.
That's right.
And they are, once again, a very articulate group of Lincoln haters who find, again, as the people in Richmond did, Lincoln to be the source of all the kinds of ills that bemoan America today. And again, what was impressive to me about them is that they kind of knew what they were talking about, and the people who were defending Lincoln would, you could say, well, why is Lincoln so great? Why do we have to build a statue to him? And it would be sort of, well, you know, Lincoln was really kind, and Lincoln was very tolerant of ambiguity, and he wasn't a triumphalist president, and these sorts of things. I thought, well, this doesn't square with the Lincoln I know, who did, after all, prosecute the bloodiest war in American history up to that point. So if Lincoln is great, it has to be for some other reason than the ones that his defenders are.
Well, what that points up almost immediately is that there are many Lincolns.
Yes.
Lincolns of the imagination, or Lincolns of the Reconstruction.
Absolutely.
Reconstructed by the human mind.
Absolutely. And this was the thing that really started me off then, after I saw that there were all of these Lincolns floating around. Everybody seemed to have his own Lincoln. When I was younger and I sort of looked up to Lincoln, there seemed to be this one national presence of Lincoln, and from that huge presence he seemed to have been whittled down and fractured so that everybody had his own Lincoln. You see this in the books that have come out over the last several years. We've had a book proving that Lincoln was a fundamentalist Christian, which was written by a fundamentalist Christian. We've had a book proving that Lincoln's greatness lay in his struggle with clinical depression, and it's written by a guy who had struggled with clinical depression. Most famously, a book proving that he was gay, which was written by a gay man.
And as you point out, a book by Mario Cuomo proving that Lincoln was really, in turn of mind, Mario Cuomo.
Mario Cuomo, exactly. You could guess who wrote the book proving that Lincoln was Cuomo. And so I thought, well, isn't there somehow not a Mario Cuomo Lincoln, not a gay Lincoln, not a depressive Lincoln, but a Lincoln Lincoln,
that's
a universal Lincoln.
How do you go about it? Well, you know, then what we come to is the search for the historical Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
Just like as you have the Besuch dem historischen Jesu, we're after
the
Besuch dem historischen Lincoln.
Absolutely.
Where do you find it?
And there are similarities.
How do you reconstruct the real Lincoln?
In Richmond, I realized, much to my chagrin, how little I really knew about Lincoln. And I thought, I want to find out about Lincoln, and I want to find out how we know what we know about Lincoln. And in doing that, you bump up immediately to this wild and woolly character named William Herndon, who was Lincoln's law partner from Springfield, and who, minutes almost after Lincoln was killed, set about on one of the greatest repertorial and research projects in American history. He took off around the Midwest, found everyone he could who had known Lincoln as a boy or a young man, and with incredible industry and precision, interviewed them and took down what they said verbatim in notes. Those notes are now in the Library of Congress in a stack several thousand pages long. And this here is the font, sort of the source of everything we know about Lincoln today. Not everything, but all of the great stories that we know of Lincoln came from Herndon. And I hadn't really learned enough about Herndon to know, you know, how much can you trust him? Is he really a good source on Lincoln or not?
There are great Lincoln scholars who've done biographies only in recent years. There's that fellow, what's his name, at Harvard? He was on this program.
David Herbert Donald.
David Donald.
Mm-hmm.
He was on this program. But so many others have done their Lincolns as well.
Yes.
As well as various novelists who've done Lincoln novels.
Sure.
Gore Vidal was one.
Yes.
What's his name? The political columnist for the New York Times, the conservative one.
William Safire.
William Safire.
Yeah.
Did one.
Mm-hmm.
As have probably, well, you probably done a count of how many books about Lincoln there are.
Right. Well, there are actually 14,000 books about Lincoln, as far as we can tell. Mm-hmm. And the only figure who has as many books written about him is Jesus. Mm-hmm. And then there's Lincoln. And then right after that, there's Napoleon. And then I think right after that is Tony Soprano, or something. It looks like, with the number of books coming out now.
You remember the story about the publishing house where they're sitting around and saying, the three topics that sell the most, we've got a survey that shows this, are Abraham Lincoln, doctors, and dogs. And then they instantly conceive they will appoint somebody to write a book titled Lincoln's Doctor's Dog.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, sometimes these books still sell. I mean, Doris Kearns Goodwin wrote a terrific book about Lincoln as a politician last year, and there was a book about the assassination, both of which became big sellers. And it's partly a tribute to Lincoln's vastness. He's just so big and has sort of penetrated so deeply into the country that not only is he unavoidable, he's almost infinite in the number of things that you can draw from him. So this allows, you know, for someone to talk about the gay Lincoln or the manic depressive Lincoln, or as what I've tried to do in this, Lincoln the cult figure, Lincoln the figure who is becomes a kind of obsession for people. And so I wanted to get at Lincoln by going through the people who feel closest.
What were some of the major stops on your peregrination?
Well, one of the first was I learned of a group called the Abraham Lincoln Presenters, which is a professional organization of men who make their livings by impersonating Abraham Lincoln. And, you know, I heard of something like that. I thought, well, this is too good to be true. And then you really, as a journalist, I realized that there actually are the journalism gods out there, because when I heard about the ALP, it was called, the Abraham Lincoln Presenters, then I heard that they had an annual convention. And then I heard that the annual convention that year was going to be held in Santa's Lodge at Santa Claus, Indiana. I thought, yes, thank you, God, this story will write itself.
So you made your reservations? And
I went down there.
Hustled to the occasion.
Yeah, and it was an absolutely terrific weekend that I spent down there with these men. They're as you would expect, having lived with Lincoln for so long and internalized so much of him, they were actually extremely sweet and kind and very patriotic
Americans.
Are they
all of the proper physical type, 6 feet four, rather lean?
The first thing I noticed, actually, is a lot of them look more like Santa Claus at Santa's Lodge than they do like Abraham Lincoln. But, you know, for them, it didn't...
Their success has gone to their girth.
Yes, somewhere. It went somewhere. Actually, a lot of them weren't successes. I noticed when I would get up the first morning I was there, I walked out into the parking lot of Santa's Lodge, which is the only hotel in Santa Claus, Indiana, and a number of them had slept in their cars because they simply didn't make enough money to be able to afford.
But they were all done up in their Lincoln suits, were they?
But they all, you know, they went in and they went and did towel baths in the restroom off the lobby of Santa's Lodge, and the thing about it for them was it seemed not to matter at all when I would talk to some of them. And you know, I met up with one guy who was, I'd say he was about 5'6", maybe weighed 270, 280, and I was talking to him and very gently tried to broach the subject of Lincoln was actually very tall and very skinny, and this gentleman was, in fact, not at all tall and not at all skinny. And he said, well, yes, but, you know, Lincoln wasn't a very handsome man either. So he had sort of convinced himself that that his not looking like Lincoln was an attribute to him.
Are there more Lincoln presenters or impersonators than Elvis?
No, I think Elvis, it's a market phenomenon. Elvis being more lucrative, there are more Elvis impersonators. For these guys, Lincoln is almost a spiritual designation. It didn't matter to them that they weren't 6'4" and weren't very skinny and didn't have the big powerful arms that Lincoln had. To them, it was a matter of conveying some kind of spiritual essence of the man.
Who was the most truly Lincoln-esque of all of these?
Well, Lincolns? There was one guy who I was just astonished to meet because he looked so much like Lincoln. He even had this sort of coloring that Lincoln had, which is kind of hard to reproduce, this sort of ruddy color. And I noticed talking to him that he even had the famous mole right by the crease in the cheek.
Is he possibly the fellow whose picture we have here?
No, he's not the man on the cover of the book who's another Lincoln impersonator. Uh-huh. But I was talking to this man, and I said, you know, I'm astonished at your resemblance. I compliment you on it. You've even got the mole there. And he said, oh, you like the mole? Here. And he dug his fingers into his cheek and extracted the mole and handed it to me. And I reared back, and I realized what he had done was he had clipped the eraser off a number 2 pencil and had epoxied it onto the crease in his cheek so he would look like Lincoln. The things they do for art, I guess.
What do they do in performance, quite apart from appearance?
Well, some of them, most of them, have memorized scraps of the speeches, and they are sometimes quite grandiloquent in the way they deliver these things. Some will assume a Shakespearean accent, which Lincoln did not have when they're reciting, say, the Gettysburg Address. Most feel most comfortable in going to school groups and fielding questions from the kids, and of course it's always the same couple of questions as, you know, are you still alive, or why are you here if you're dead, and they've all had sort of pat answers. In fact, one of the really quite nice things about the convention was sitting with them while they shared stories about how you handle various difficult situations as a Lincoln impersonator.
Yes, one of them being, what do you do when a kid comes up and says, how did you die?
Right. And the one Lincoln impersonator said, presenter, said, well, I have a hats off time. And so when someone asks me how I died, I take the hat off and say, okay, I'm not Lincoln anymore. And then he'll explain how the assassination took place. Mm-hmm. And then it's hats on time, and he puts the hat back on, and he can resume being Lincoln. There was also a great deal of conversation about hats. One guy was sending out a warning among his fellow Abes, as they're called, letting them know that Walmart had just come out with a new line of top hat, only $6, and he was worried that some of his colleagues might be seduced by these new Walmart hats, but he had already bought one, and the brim had fallen clear down to his neck when he put it on the first time. So he said, buyer beware.
Let's move on from Santa Claus, Indiana. Where did you go next? Why did you go there?
Well, from Santa Claus, I believe my next stop was, I was still in the Midwest, and I went out to Springfield, which is, of course, the...
A basic stop.
Yeah, the place for all...
You had been there as a kid.
Yes. And as I mentioned earlier, when I went there, all the road signs directed you to the Lincoln Shrines. Now, as I think part of our general devaluing of our and debunking of our historical heritage, they're now called the Lincoln Sites.
A basic item in my cultural literacy quiz, which I used to give to my students at the university, and which I still employ when we're trying to hire somebody to produce this program, just a few items. And one basic item is, what are the dates of the American Civil War? And you find that sophomores and juniors at the University of Chicago, not more than 1 out of 10 can give you the exactly proper date, 1861 to 1865. That relates to what you say in the very beginning of your book, in your preface,
yes,
that our sense of American history is fading fast, and is where it isn't totally amnesiac, it is replaced by popular corruptions,
yes,
of the real facts.
Yes, and there's a kind of cynicism that creeped in. You know, the historian C. Van Woodward had a phrase called the fall of the American Adam, and he was referring to that periods beginning in the, say, mid to late 60s through the 70s, where cynicism about our history and about the traditional heroes of American history became a mark of sophistication and worldliness. And that...
seeing through everything.
Yeah, so, you know, you can't pull the wool over my eyes, you know, wake up and smell the coffee sort of thing. You know, there is certainly room for skepticism, but it became almost a reflex, a default position for somebody who wants to kind of prove his worldliness without actually having to be worldly.
And about Abraham Lincoln, if you remember him at all, some of the cynical things that are easy to say is he was just as much a racist as Jefferson Davis was.
Yes, absolutely. One of my formative books when I was a kid was a child's book called Abraham Lincoln by a husband and wife team, the Dallaires, which is still in print. And it's a magnificent book for kids. It's beautifully illustrated, and it takes Lincoln up through his, not quite to the assassination, which was a great disappointment to me when I was a kid, because I hate to miss out on such a splendidly heartbreaking death as Lincoln's assassination. But I still internalize it all, and then I went off to college, and I met another kid in college, a very sophisticated, smart kid, and it turned out we had both been Lincoln buffs as children, and we had both read this book by the Dallaires and had been greatly indebted to it. And I said, you know, my favorite scene was always the scene where Lincoln goes on a flatboat down to New Orleans and he sees the slave auction there. And it repulses him so much that it transforms his life. And he says, you know, someday I'm going to hit that thing and I'm going to hit it hard. And my friend, who was much more worldly and sophisticated than I, said, oh, yeah, what a load of junk that was. Except he didn't use the word junk. And he explained to me, well, you know, Lincoln was just as much a racist as Jefferson Davis was. What he really wanted to do was ship all the slaves back to Africa or Costa Rica. He went down the litany. The Emancipation Proclamation didn't free any slaves. The slaves that he might have freed, he refused to free, and so on and so on and so on. And he was sort of a man of the left, but his critique of Lincoln was actually very close to the critique that I then found years later in Richmond from men on the right.
Is there any, to pardon the simple, direct, and plaintive query, but is there anything to that view at all?
There is enough that it will never go away. Mm-hmm. It's the interesting thing about these Lincoln haters is that very often they've read very deeply, but not very widely. So they will point out to you that, you know, Lincoln wasn't an abolitionist. Well, that's true on its face, and Lincoln did not have contemporary attitudes about race. He certainly wasn't a racial liberal as we would define him. That's true as well. But that's not the whole story. The whole story was Lincoln was not an abolitionist, but he was strongly anti-slavery, and he had definite views on how slavery
could
be extinguished.
It's in all of his significant orations as he's gearing up to make a try for the presidency. The Cooper Union speech, which is in what year, 58 or?
59. In the early 60s.
Is a full condemnation of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a Christian condemnation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And where it's true that Lincoln was not an abolitionist in the sense that he refused to think that as president he could wave a wand and simply do away with slavery, which is sort of still the temptation that I think a lot of people have in politics. You know, why can't you just do the right thing? Lincoln saw that the surest way to get rid of slavery and to make sure that slavery never came back was to respect the institutions of free government and preserve those first, have the priority of keeping democracy alive, and then the extinguishing slavery would be extinguished automatically.
Or not there is one serious eventually. Critical question that can be raised about Lincoln, and it's one which has occurred to me again and again as I read stuff about Lincoln, and that is, what would have been the consequence if you went down an alternate time track, namely that Lincoln had taken the attitude, we want the South, but if they want to go, let them go.
Right.
If you allowed the secession, there are various people have conjectured about that and have worked out alternative histories of what would have happened to those two separate, formerly combined, formerly unitary nations,
yes.
The United States of America and the Confederate States of America.
Right.
We might speculate about that a bit when we return, as we will in just a few minutes. Quite shortly, we're going to the newsroom. But before that, I do want to remind all who are listening that the blog that goes with this program, miltsfile.com, has some very interesting stuff on it, I think, because I select it and I annotate it and put it before you. And yet I don't mention it often enough on the air. So hereby I am mentioning that we've got a blog that has been there for a number of years and that lots of people plug in on, but still others don't know of its existence. miltsfile.com. And you get to that that way, or you can go directly to the website for the radio station, and that will lead you down a not-too-devious path to the same location, miltsfile.com. And we will return to directly to Andrew Ferguson, drawing from his new book, Land of Lincoln, Adventures in Abe's America. And we return to Andrew Ferguson as we wander the land of Lincoln with him, that being the title of his wonderful new book, a subtitle, Adventures in Abe's America. And we should, of course, identify the publisher, and I forget who it is.
It's Grove Atlantic Press, the Atlantic Monthly Press.
Good enough. Well, the question I was raising, really, was could there have been an alternative approach to the whole thing? Do we have to blame the Civil War in some part upon Lincoln? We have to blame it upon the secessionists, of course. But what if, as some people advocated even at the time, let them go.
Mm-hmm.
Let them go. Ultimately, they may come back, and if they don't, is their problem. It will be hard for them, and slavery is bound to decay anyway within a decade or two.
Right. This is also a very common view that you hear among the people who don't like Lincoln very much.
Yeah.
Lincoln's response to that was, if you allow the right to secession, if every time some group in the country doesn't like the results of an election and uses it as an excuse to secede, you don't have a country. What you have is a sort of a loose coagulation of ever-shifting alliances, and there would be, there would be no principle by which the Confederate States of America would have maintained itself as a viable country. And for Lincoln, that was not a small, it was not a small detail. Lincoln really believed that in a certain kind of way, the future of humanity was tied up in the future of the United States, that the United States was a vessel of a principle that was both metaphysical and political, which is the idea that all men are created equal. If the country was allowed to die, the principle would fade away, and the principle couldn't be allowed to fade away.
You have not been disabused of your reverence for Lincoln.
Not at all. I lost it for a while when I lost interest in Lincoln for a good 20 years or so. And I would find when I would hang around people who really disliked him, and I would hear their arguments, which, as I say, could be quite compelling sometimes, the greatest antidote to Lincoln's cynicism or Lincoln's skepticism was to simply go back and read him himself, read his words, sit down with a volume of the Collected Works of Abraham Lincoln, which run to 9 volumes, or one of the many collections of his speeches and letters. And the clarity of his language and the almost poetry of his ideas were enough to disabuse me of any temptation that I had. But, you know, he really wasn't that great of a guy.
Actually, he poses the same problem that Shakespeare does. That is, how could somebody of so little education have become such a master, not merely of moral clarity, but of language?
Yes.
And how could he have developed so personal, inimitable a style, and yet a very high style, as well as the grace of fine and significant analytic thought, and ultimately decent and humane values?
Yeah.
That's, I'm speaking of Lincoln, you would have another kind of list of virtues for Shakespeare, surely, though, the language and the great skill, the virtual explosive use of the English language that you have from Shakespeare is unaccountable to lots of people who are critical, and particularly those who then argue Shakespeare couldn't have been Shakespeare.
Right,
it was somebody else.
Well, you know, I still see this actually among Lincoln lovers and people who greatly admire Lincoln who aren't like me from the Midwest, or and you know, he came from almost Bronze Age background in Kentucky, which is in where he grew up is still the middle of nowhere. I mean, it's very hard to get to by, you can't get there by interstate or anything like that. And I see, of course, this was held against him throughout his life as he emerged as a formidable politician, undeniably a very serious politician. People in the East simply could not imagine that that such a creature could arise from the prairie. And it's still true today. When you find, especially Lincoln admirers on the East Coast, they look back at Springfield, which is, you know, a small and is certainly not a cosmopolitan town today, even. And they say, now, why couldn't Lincoln have come from the Upper East Side? How could somebody so wonderful, and as you say, such a poet and such a thinker and such a moral giant, have come from nowhere? You know, you should have at least come from Nyack, if not the Upper East Side.
The fact is that God, nature, or whatever, provides us with, casts up some people who are of genius quality and are not accountable in ordinary psychological terms.
Yes, and you see this, I mentioned the Herndon papers early. One of the themes that runs through the interviews that Herndon had with the people that he interviewed is this sense, even among the people who knew him casually in New Salem and other places that he lived before he grew to manhood, is there is something extraordinary about him and something sort of mysterious and something untouchable, basically. There was some reserve that he had. It would come across as, you know, a sort of a dreamy quality or something, but there was some little bit of him that was always too deep for anybody to quite touch.
Apart from your wandering around the country in search of the land of Lincoln, you also wander in and out of the movies and in and out of printed literature.
Mm-hmm.
We've had so many representations of Lincoln. You make mention of a number of the famous films. Which ones particularly moved you?
Well, as a kid, I was... I would be brought to tears every time I saw Young Mr. Lincoln by John Ford. Henry Fonda, which is, I loved because it's concentrates on Lincoln's time in Illinois. And there are a number of figures in it that any reader of one of the Lincoln children's books will know about, the Armstrong boys, the young neighborhood toughs that Lincoln befriends. And there was it's an extremely sentimental movie, but it to me was very it sort of captured this sense of which Lincoln's growth as a from a young man from the prairie to a very sophisticated knowledge worker, as we would say today, paralleled the growth of the country. And this is one of the things also that Herndon tries to get across, is that what happened to Lincoln was also happening to the country. You come from this kind of Bronze Age background, you find a book, and the book offers you a way out of the hard scrabble yeoman's life that faces you. And as you, the deeper you go into the book, into the world of law and literature and the sort of civilization, the parts of the civilization that were absent from where he grew up, the more you make the country. And the country itself had gone through this same progress. And you really see that in the John Ford movie, Young Mr. Lincoln.
And then there's Raymond Massey as Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
What is that one called?
That's the Abe Lincoln in Illinois. Lincoln, yeah, which is Robert Sherwood.
It ends with his departure for Washington on the presidential train.
Yes. And that actually, I don't think has worn quite as well as the earlier one. It's much more melodramatic, has much less of the kind of simplicity and economy that we admire.
And the subplot, which weaves in and out, is his troubled relationship with his wife, Mary.
Yes, it was quite forthright about that. I saw this going among Lincoln buffs today, is that people who, historians in particular, who have a very high place very high value on Lincoln's greatness, tend to really discount Mary Todd Lincoln, if not dislike her. Whereas there is a smaller group of historians now who are trying to rediscover Mary Lincoln And the more they sort of side with her, the less fondly they think of Lincoln himself. They had a very difficult marriage. Of course, every marriage is unfathomable to a certain degree, and it's kind of presumptuous to pretend that historians could fathom what happened in Lincoln's marriage. But, you know, a few of these things are undeniable. He was gone 6 months out of every year during their married life, 3 months on the circuit in the spring, 3 months in the fall. The remaining 6 months, when he might have been at home helping her with children and so on, he was off politicking. So it suggests that there was something not quite right with the marriage.
One of the cruelest little gags in American, in the lexicon of American humor, this is used to be big with college students when I was a college student, is simply the line, "But apart from that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you like the play?"
Right, right, right. Well, she had a very hard life, and no one can. I kind of feel bad that people tend to take sides on this thing. It's almost like a divorce, you know. Somebody decides whether you have to side with the husband.
Well, that
or the
son
wife.
Who founded the law firm that your father worked
right.
in, Robert Todd Lincoln, had her incarcerated later in life.
Yeah, right here outside of Chicago in a booby hatch, as we used to call it. He may have had reasons that are a little more explainable. I mean, there were problems with the will. He didn't really seem to have he didn't seem to be able to take care of her any other way short of kind of incarcerating her, the way the law was at the time. But there's no question that the cruelty of it is undeniable, and the terrible tragedy of her dying and spending her last years in a darkened bedroom as she did. Not speaking to anyone, even her sister, to whom she'd always been close, is an awful American tragedy. Mm-hmm.
We are about to pause for a round of commercials. When we return, we must get back on the road with you, and particularly look at Lincolniana, that is, the collectors of Lincoln stuff. There's particularly that woman out on the West Coast, who I gather is the greatest of all the collectors.
Absolutely.
And we will talk about what she's got and what she's done with it. And my very special guest, an American writer whose work I much admire and always enjoy when I encounter it directly in the pages of the Weekly Standard, of which he is officially, what are you, an associate editor?
A senior editor.
Senior editor.
Which means I have no seniority and I don't have to edit.
But they'll print whatever you
yes, exactly.
whatever you write.
Yeah.
And what you write is well worth printing always. And I'm eager to, as a matter of fact, if you want to get a quick acquaintance with the work of Andrew Ferguson, apart from his fine new book, Land of Lincoln, Adventures in Abe's America, you can simply go to the Internet. Do you have a site of your own?
No, I don't.
But I just today Googled you, so to speak, and a number of your articles came up.
Yeah, I'm sure they're out
including
there.
Including one just from the Washington Post just a few days ago,
right.
in which you're talking about Lincoln.
Yeah. I happen to be reading Al Gore's new book, about a third of the way through the book, all of a sudden it pops up this Lincoln quote.
It's a great quotation from Lincoln.
Yeah, a marvelously precise expression of Al Gore's own views. And you read it, and it's all about the dangers of corporate corruption in America and how the war, the unnamed war, has unleashed all these corporate villains and so on. And I saw the thing, that quote sounded awful familiar to me, but it doesn't sound like Lincoln.
The cadences are all wrong.
Yeah, and the point of view is wrong. Lincoln was himself, of course, a corporate lawyer and a great capitalist himself. And so anyway, it's not hard to check, but the quote had been debunked. And in fact, many, many times over the years, and in fact was first arose in 1880s to advertise patent medicine, and of course it hadn't been appropriated by various other groups through the years. But I thought this was a convenient way for me to talk about one of the themes of the book too, in the pages of the Washington Post, which was, and the theme being that we pretend that we want us and our children and so on to be like Lincoln, to be kind and resolute and so on. But what we really want is for Lincoln to be like us. And if we have to draw on very implausible quotations to do it, we'll do it.
Now, let's talk briefly, as I signaled earlier, we really should, about the collectors.
Yes.
I suppose Lincoln memorabilia is a great category for collectors, even bigger than Elvis memorabilia, I should think.
Oh, yes. It's certainly, again, you have to get back to Napoleon and that kind of thing before you find anything like the Field and Lincoln collecting. I went out to Beverly Hills, California, where a widow lives in a spectacular mansion. I think I say in the book that it's the biggest house I've ever been in that wasn't once owned by royalty. And she took me in and showed me around her house, and she is the greatest, has the greatest private collection of Lincoln stuff in the world. And it is just remarkable stuff. I mean, she opened up her vault for me and we sat on the floor, and she started handing me things of, you know, she has a page from Lincoln's little arithmetic book that he used when he was a teenage boy. She has hundreds of his letters. She even has his chamber pot. And I remember that he used in the White House, and I remember her pointing this out to me in a glass case. She said, "That's Lincoln's chamber pot." And I looked at her and I said, "You own Abraham Lincoln's chamber pot," which is a sentence I never thought I would ever speak. And she kind of thought about it as though it had never occurred to her either. And she said, "Yes, you know, I do." But there it sits in this marvelous.
Frankly, I was stunned when I encountered that in your book, to think that in Lincoln's time, the flush toilet having been invented and installed probably in many places in this country, I was amazed to learn that.
But not in the White House.
There were none in the White House.
No, there weren't. And, of course, to have something like that for, I suppose I shouldn't talk too much about the chamber pot, but it was clear talking to this woman who had the resources that she could pretty much buy any piece of Lincoln item that would ever be available, that there was some kind of, she drew some kind of sustenance from merely holding these things. She opened up a drawer and pulled out Mary Lincoln's undergarments. She had Lincoln's wallet. She had things that she thought to her spoke of the love that Mary and Abraham Lincoln had, which was a very important. She herself had a very happy marriage. And she wanted to have her collection reflect this personal aspect of Lincoln and Lincoln's intimate life. And I saw this with collectors all the way through, especially if they had the kind of resources that her name is Louise Taper. That she had, people are at once projecting themselves onto Lincoln and trying to draw Lincoln close through the magic of the things that he held and wrote.
Is there a persisting kind of consensual image of Lincoln that, though it may be growing a little dim, or lots of people aren't aware that it's there, is there still an American consensus on Lincoln that works as part of our cultural heritage?
Well, that actually is sort of what I wanted to find. That was the big question I wanted to find in the book, and I believe there is. I think that we're ignoring it because we're sort of because we live in such a fragmented age, and Lincoln himself has become a victim of that. In our own infatuation with as I say, trying to make Lincoln like us, we have sort of lost this large and universal Lincoln, the Lincoln, as I say, the Lincoln that earlier generations could draw inspiration from. Everywhere I went, I saw people disparaging what they called the iconic Lincoln or the icon. It was quite extraordinary. It was a theme that ran through almost everyone I spoke with. They said, "Well, you know, we're going to get beyond the icon. We don't want that plaster saint. We don't want this big remote figure that earlier generations had. We want the human Lincoln," and so on. And it turned out to me, as I went from one sort of implausible little mini privatized Lincoln to another, that the icon, in fact, was more plausible, and that there was something truer about this iconic Lincoln than there was about all the little tiny individualized Lincolns that I saw.
You must have, we were playing with historical contingency just earlier, the other contingency scenario must have occurred to and preoccupied you at times. What if John Wilkes Booth had missed?
Yes. He might have shot the wife in that case, and then she wouldn't. This is a question that can drive people crazy if you go on too long. The evidence of what Lincoln had in mind for the end of the war, of course, he died right at the end of the war, tends to point to a certain direction. The one of the most famous examples is, of course, when the commander in Richmond talked about the prisoners of war that they had and what he should do with the civilian population in the capital of the Confederacy. Lincoln famously said, let them up easy, let them up real easy. And his last public speech, in fact, the reason he was killed, was delivered from the back of the White House and in the audience, in the small audience that hot night, was John Wilkes Booth. And Lincoln, for the first time, in fact, the first time that any truly responsible statesman in America had ever brought this up, said, maybe we ought to consider the possibility of giving blacks the vote in newly liberated Louisiana. He wrote this also in a letter to the governor of Louisiana. And when he said it out loud, John Wilkes Booth turned to a friend and said, that's it. And sure enough, 3 days later, he killed him. So it's pretty clear that Lincoln was the conciliator that we now think of him as, and that he's come down in history to us.
Of course, without that tragic death, without the assassination, which is a kind of immolation, he would not have retained, he would not have achieved and retained that iconic status
yes.
in our national memory.
Yes, this is the paradox. On the one hand, the country might have been better off, would have been, I think, better off had he lived. I think Reconstruction would have been handled in a much different sort of way. On the other hand, the country has benefited by having this, to my way of mind, this iconic Lincoln to draw upon and to look towards for inspiration. And you're quite right. It would not have happened had he not been killed. You see this actually in the Herndon documents. One of the things when you drift all the way down to the bottom of this pile of interviews that Herndon conducted after Lincoln's death, you start to see little glimmers of things that no one was supposed to know about Lincoln that were covered up. For example, I have quite a bit in here about his sense of humor and what scholars have discovered about it. He loved dirty jokes, and I mean real dirty jokes. He dropped the F-bomb, as we say nowadays, with some frequency, and was not above the crudest kind of sexual humor. But no one knew about this because Herndon himself wanted to cover it up. There were a couple of reasons for this. One is he didn't want to interfere with the construction of this martyr mm-hmm. that was going on. On the other hand, it was bad business. If you were writing a book about Lincoln and you pointed out that Lincoln used rough language, that he told dirty stories, you weren't going to be able to sell your book. And that, so there was a natural suppression as the martyr was being elevated.
There's a word I've always loved, apotheosis, mm-hmm. transforming someone into a godlike figure.
Yes.
I would think the great apotheosis of Lincoln, it had been done earlier, but the full flowering of an elevation to near God status was done by Carl Sandburg.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, the famous quote about that is from the literary critic Edmund Wilson, who said that the worst thing that happened to Lincoln since John Wilkes Booth was falling into the hands of Carl Sandburg. Now, I think Sandburg has gotten...
I think Wilson is too hard on that.
Yeah, I do too. There is a poetical aspect, I suppose you could say, mm-hmm. about Sandburg. But again, that doesn't mean that it's not true. It's very hard to trace some of Sandburg's sources. Some of the stories seem to have come up from out of the ether, but the book is compelling, and the figure that emerges from it is very well rounded, and there are again, as in the icon, there are deep truths that Sandburg conveyed about Lincoln.
I read it as a young man and was quite moved by it,
mm-hmm.
and in this conversation I suddenly have developed an urge to reread it, or
yeah.
at least look at it again.
Yeah,
I do have it at home.
Well, and there's a beautiful one-volume condensation
yeah.
That was...
The original, I think, is four volumes.
Six, actually.
Six.
Yeah.
There you are. And again, my guest is Andrew Ferguson, author of the wonderful new book, Land of Lincoln, Adventures in Abe's America. I've had great pleasure reading this book, learned a great deal about the uses and the misuses of the memory of Abraham Lincoln. And we will, and also a wonderful, interesting... characters one encounters in this. How many different places did you go to I was about to say once again, in this pilgrimage or peregrination.
Yeah, I suppose probably there's a dozen or so recounted in the book.
Yeah.
But that's pared down from many, many more that ended up on the cutting room floor.
Interesting. There's a film in the works or a TV?
A documentary.
So TV documentary.
Yeah, we're talking about doing a documentary for PBS.
We go to the phones directly, 591-7200. You are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, good evening, Doctor. Great show as usual.
Thank you, sir.
I'm a big fan of Lincoln. I grew up mostly in Illinois, but, you know, you talk about collectibles and things. One of the most interesting portrayals I've seen of him was about 20 years ago. They had a commercial for the GED program where a very convincing-looking Lincoln is sitting in a little shabby employment office. And the guy asked him, well, what degrees do you have, Lincoln? And he goes, well, I kind of did a lot of reading on my own. And he goes, hey, Lincoln, I know you're a smart guy. You know you're a smart guy, but without that sheepskin, you know, and he looks really dejected. And at the end, the guy says, hey, Lincoln, you got your chauffeur's license. And it was kind of interesting. It showed how what he achieved in his day and how implausible it would be today. And it was treated with respect. But, you know, it seems like when he is portrayed, it's usually with respect. You know, you don't see him being made fun of in our society. I think he's just such a part of our fabric. And I was wondering if your Mr. Ferguson was familiar with that spot from years ago.
No, I haven't seen it, but it sounds ingenious and actually conveys something that's definitely true. I've noticed this, too. I think it's very perceptive that among the kinds of, given how the vulgarity to which the popular culture can fall sometimes, I'm really heartened by the fact that Lincoln is still treated 90% of the time with a kind of appropriate respect. There is a television show on it, a sitcom about 5 or 6 years ago that a number of the Abraham Lincoln presenters got together and picketed out in Hollywood because it showed Lincoln in a really awful, salacious way, and I think it was supposed to be a parody of the Clinton-Lewinsky scandals, and so Lincoln was shown having an affair with an intern in the Oval Office and so on. It was really, really awful, but generally when there's something like that, the culture itself rebels against it and kind of expels it.
Yeah, more recently, too, he's being featured in the Ambien commercial, I think, for
Sleep I've Aid. Seen that one, yes, with the strange creature alongside him, and they're welcoming the fellow because they've been in his dreams.
Exactly, and they have the chessboard set up. And again, he's a kindly fellow, intelligent, and he's treated with respect. So I kind of enjoy seeing that, and I look forward to that book.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir, for the call.
Have a good night.
Well, glad to have heard from you.
Truism in that, of course, is and what I think is respectful about that is that Lincoln does lurk in the subconscious of so many Americans that it's. He kind of comes up at the most unexpected times.
Has he, in fact, penetrated your dreams, as he does in that commercial?
Yes, actually. Yeah. I'm afraid I've had Abraham Lincoln dreams. I'd rather not go into the details, but there's nothing scandalous about it. But, you know, sometimes you get so far into the subject of a book, you can't find your way out.
Yeah, inevitably. Back to the phones, 591-7200, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, good evening. I've enjoyed the discussion immensely. The point that I wanted to make was that I think one aspect of Abraham Lincoln that is not commonly known is that from the beginning of his career, he had a sense of America's power and of America's future role in the world. In one of his first speeches, a speech that he gave in Springfield before he was 30 years old, he talked about how he said that all the armies of Europe, commanded by a Bonaparte, could never conquer the United States. They could never drink from the waters of the great Ohio. And on the last day of his life, he told, I believe it was Schuyler Colfax, that he foresaw with the end of the Civil War that there would be great waves of immigration coming to the United States, and that we would become the richest nation on earth. He called it the treasurer of the world. And I think it's just fascinating that at a time when the powers of Europe thought little of the United States, Lincoln had this sense of what America would become in the 20th century, both militarily and economically. And I think that perhaps one of the reasons why he was so determined to stop the attempt at secession was that he had this sense of America's destiny, and he was not going to let America be brought down.
I think that's absolutely true and very well said. The potential that he saw in the United States came from the faith that he had in the idea of self-government, which he believed was rooted in the idea that all men are created equal. And it wasn't just that self-government and democracy, as we would call it, was correct and just. It was also going to be the most effective form of government that anyone could conceive of. And that, to him, made it all the more precious that the country continue to live up to the creed.
And he also, he dated our birth as a nation to 1776, that poetry about 47 years ago. He was asserting that we had become a nation at the very beginning, at the Declaration of Independence, not with the Constitution, as some would have argued. He argued that we were not just a collection of states, even on the 4th of July, 1776, that we were a nation from the very beginning. He had this strong sense of America as a nation.
Yes, he believed that the Union preceded the states,
right,
as it were, and that the Constitution was the way of fleshing out the principles that were in the Declaration. And this, you know, this is, to this day, there are people who despise that idea. But he did reorient the country so that it's on that basis now, and I think that it worked pretty darn well.
Sir, thank you. An excellent contribution.
Thank you very much.
And we'll go quickly to another on 591-7200. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. Was Mr. Lincoln an active note-taker when he was reading, and what kind of insights do we get from the margins?
Oh, that's a very good question. No, in fact, unlike, say, John Adams's books, which are filled with marginalia, and in fact sometimes wonderfully humorous and sardonic comments on his contemporaries, Lincoln did not write in the few books that he owned. What he did do, however, was read aloud, which drove Herndon, his law partner, crazy, because he would sit there when he was trying to do legal research, and he would lie on the divan there in their law office and read the law books out loud. Apparently, he never quite mastered the art of reading silently.
Thank you.
We thank you, sir. Speaking of books, one of the great lines, and there's so much humor in the record of Lincoln's performance, somebody sends him a book and looks for accommodation, looks maybe for a blurb, and his response, remember this, is, this book will interest those who are interested in this sort of book.
Right. It's almost sort of like none ever wished it longer than it was.
Yes.
But that was a typical.
What's one or what are two of your favorite Lincoln witty comments?
I haven't had a chance much to talk about Springfield, but there was a story that he told about Springfield, which is a town that I revere and love, in fact. But Lincoln had a very ambivalent relationship to it. And he once told the story of a traveling itinerant preacher who had come to town and wanted to give a series of sermons. And they said, well, you have to get a clearance from the Secretary of State before you can do that. And so the preacher went to the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of State said, well, what's the theme of your sermons? And the guy said, well, I'm preaching on the second coming of the Lord. And the Secretary of State said, well, don't bother, because if the Lord's seen Springfield once, he ain't coming back. Which is a pretty good joke to tell in your own hometown.
What do you make of this? Here's an email I've got in front of me. Is this pure apocrypha, or might this have some basis in fact? This listener says, gentlemen, I have a friend in Monmouth, Illinois, who has in his possession a penknife that purportedly once belonged to Lincoln. The story goes that when Lincoln used to ride on the circuit, he was accosted by a stranger who said, excuse me, sir, but I have an article in my possession which belongs to you. How is that? Lincoln asked, considerably astonished. The stranger took a penknife from his pocket. This knife, said he, was placed in my hand some years ago with the injunction that I was to keep it until I had found a man uglier than myself. I have carried it from that time to this, Allow me to say, sir, that I think you are fairly entitled to the property. Lincoln had an old friend in Oquaqua, Illinois, Alexis Phelps, who was a homely man and, in fact, looked very much like Lincoln. According to my friend, Lincoln presented Phelps with a knife, saying, "At last I have found someone uglier than myself." The knife was kept in the Phelps family for several years and eventually given to the cousin, given to the uncle of my friend, from whom he inherited it.
Well,
does that relate to anything you've heard?
Yes, before? Actually, Lincoln used to tell the story himself of a woman who came up to me, or came up to him on the street and said, handed him something and said, "You know, I've kept this waiting to see if I actually met the ugliest man on earth, and here you are." So it sounds like somebody took one of these great Lincoln stories and used it as kind of what they call provenance in the culture's work.
But our correspondent apparently believes that the knife really had that history.
Yes. Well, the key to these things always is the precision with which the story is told, which kind of led into the
more precise, the less likely.
Probably.
And directly back to the phones. 591-7200, you are on the air. Good evening.
Hello. How are you tonight?
Sir. Good. Go ahead.
Yes, I've really enjoyed the discussion tonight, and I've appreciated your comments, especially about the iconic figure of Lincoln. And I was hoping to get a couple of comments from you and your guest regarding a book that I had read recently from 2005 called The Team of Rivals, where it discussed his ability to put together a team of people that you would never have in today's political arena, who were his foes, who were running against him, and it just showed Lincoln's character in caring more about the country and wanting to find the best people and assemble a team and being able to get into their heads and realize what they cared about and put them in positions to help grow the country and not worry about who they were as political rivals to it.
Yes, that's absolutely true, and I think that book has done a wonderful service in reviving our appreciation of Lincoln as a politician.
Is that the Doris Kearns Goodwin?
Yes, yeah. Doris Kearns Goodwin, who was also nice enough to write a nice blurb for Land of Lincoln. But we're in such a cynical age now, I think, that we tend to think that politics is a dirty and a grubby business.
Yes.
But the fact of it is that if you really hate politics, it's sort of a way of saying you don't much like democracy and self-government, because self-government expresses itself through politics. And it's often the case that you have to do things, given human imperfections, that may seem unseemly at the time. But the actual act of politics, the business of politics, should be elevating and ennobling. And I think that's one of the lessons we have to teach, or that we have to learn from Lincoln, even though Lincoln himself was a politician down to the very soles of his boots.
Yeah, I was just very impressed with the book, and it made me more impressed with who the character of Lincoln was over, you know, all the other books that I had read over the years, and it just helped cement his place in history to me personally.
Yes.
We thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Glad to have heard from you. What was it like living in the White House for the Lincoln family?
It was hell, actually. It was a dingy, rundown building, and there was very little privacy. The actual workspace wasn't really separated from the public space, and people were free to come in and out. Lincoln had suffered from a terrible choice in bodyguards. They would wander off during the night. They would wander off during the day. He had to walk a gauntlet of office seekers and favor seekers from his private quarters to the office, which was on the other side of the building. On top of all of this, it was sort of unsanitary because there was a malarial stream right out the back. On top of all of it, he had his two young children, two young boys, in the White House for the first year, one of whom caught sick, probably from something from the malarial conditions that had carried over into the winter when he died. Then it was left burying his own son in the middle of this incredible war. His wife didn't handle it very well. This was the second child she'd lost, and she was bedridden for many months and finally never really restored herself mentally. We really can't. It's very difficult to conceive of the kinds. We use words like stress and pressure. Yeah. It's almost impossible to imagine.
It's the ordeal of Abraham Lincoln.
Yes, absolutely.
Terrible burden to carry.
Yeah.
The war itself, of course, was
the war by itself would be more than a man would think to be able to bear. But on top of it, the disintegration of his wife, the loss of his favorite son, being surrounded by people who didn't really have his best or the country's best interests in mind. It's piled on top of each other. It's almost inconceivable.
Mm-hmm. A few more quick calls as we go. 591-7200 is the number. You are the next caller. Good evening.
Hi. I'm enjoying the conversation very much tonight. And I live in Ottawa, Illinois, and we're a big Lincoln city. And we have a park that has a beautiful statue of Lincoln and Douglas. And today, in our newspaper, they've unveiled this painting that's a 90-by-20-foot mural that's being painted on a wall about from the Lincoln-Douglas debate. And our area is a very nice area. If your guest is ever interested in coming to a town that has a lot of Lincoln heritage here.
Oh, I've been down there, and I love Ottawa, and I agree with you about the.
Have you seen the new mural that?
No, I haven't seen the mural. I heard about it, but.
Well, the Times paper is it's in tonight's paper on the internet. If you wanted to read the article, it's really I think it's going to be a beautiful thing.
Oh, thank you. I'll look forward to that. You know, we're seeing this all throughout. Central Illinois, especially since the opening of the museum down in Springfield, there's been a...
Well, that's beautiful, too. We really enjoyed that.
Yeah, there's been a tremendous revival of interest, and I think people realizing that you can turn Lincoln into kind of a cash cow.
But you do rather have mixed feelings about that museum. And...
Yes, I devote a chapter to it, and there are many things going on with the museum. One is, of course, just on the raw level of politics. What began as a relatively modest affair to improve the facilities of the Illinois State Library and to display some of the wonderful Lincoln artifacts that they have, approximately a $10 million project, ending up in classic Illinois fashion to being a $160 million thing. And anyway, so you're never quite sure in Illinois how these things happen.
Well, this in Ottawa looks like it's going to be nice. And we used to have a man here that resembled Lincoln so much. His name was Dave Morgan, and he used to dress in costume, and he had a popcorn wagon by the park. And every summer he would dress in his outfit and make the popcorn and sell it out of this old wagon that sat there. And so everybody around this area always knew who he was because they called him Abe, you know.
Right.
But I've enjoyed the conversation tonight.
And we've enjoyed hearing from you, ma'am. Thank you for the call.
Okay, bye.
Good night. Let me read you another email. Great show, exclamation point. I recently read a book entitled Forced into Glory by Lerone Bennett. The thesis of the book is that Lincoln was a virulent racist, and that his main objective was to deport all freed slaves to Africa or the Caribbean, and that the Emancipation Proclamation was a sham. Assuming your guest is familiar with his book, I would appreciate his comments. Of course, we've discussed this view of Lincoln earlier tonight, but the particular book by Lerone Bennett, Forced into Glory.
Yeah, Mr. Bennett was a journalist and still is, I believe, with Ebony Magazine, and wrote a very important article in 1968 in the midst of the Black Power movement, making these claims about Lincoln as a virulent racist and the Emancipation Proclamation being a worthless document and so on. And it took him about 30 years, but he finally expanded that newspaper or magazine article into a huge book that sets forth the same points in a much expanded form. What's interesting about it to me is how this argument, as we talked about before, is so closely related to the argument, which I think you'd call a sort of a left-wing argument, is very closely related to the right-wing critique of Lincoln. And it has to do, again, with the sense that Lincoln is all mixed up in the country, and your feelings, one's feelings towards the country, then become reflected in how you feel about Lincoln. And I think Lerone Bennett's dissatisfaction with the racial history of America and the political history of America is, for him, indistinguishable from the figure of Lincoln.
Are we going to go on worrying that issue till the end of time, or until American memory fades away?
Yes, partly because Lincoln does call up and implicate the most fundamental questions about the country. Yeah. What kind of country is it? What's it for? As the earlier caller pointed out, what's its role in the world? Does it have a kind of role as a model for the rest of the world, or are we just an ordinary country, one other country among other countries? Lincoln implicates all of those questions, and anybody who wants to deal with them seriously has to deal with Lincoln.
I've said nothing tonight about, except that I've endorsed and said I love to read your regular journalism as we find it in the Weekly Standard and elsewhere. But I've already indicated the Weekly Standard is essentially a conservative, or some would call it a neoconservative magazine. Plays that role, I think, much as, say, the New Republic does as a sort of a standard established liberal magazine. Mm-hmm. How does one relate your interest in Lincoln and this quest that you've been on to your general political positioning?
Well, that's a good question that I haven't really tried to sort out myself. My interest in Lincoln was partly personal and partly professional, that is to say, journalistic. And I think that in writing about Lincoln, I've discovered I was really writing about the country. And this is sort of my earlier point, that understanding Lincoln is a way of understanding America. And I wrote it much less as an ideological project and much more as a journalistic one and almost a sociological one, to try and describe the country by describing this one seminal figure.
If Abraham Lincoln reads in heaven and is up to date, how do you think he would react to the Weekly Standard?
I think he'd think the articles were too short. No, I don't know what he would think. It's very hard to believe. One of the things that I've objected to the point I make in the book, and I keep running into Lincoln people and meeting them, is the sort of glib way in which they try and transplant this figure from the 1860s and assign to him the political views that they would prefer. I have no understanding of what Lincoln would think about the war in Iraq, or what he would think about capital gains tax rates, or what he would think about even affirmative action or some of the other charged issues of the day. He was a man of his time. But because he was such a deep thinker and a man of such moral clarity, he calls up principles that are almost beyond politics.
It's been a delight to see you again and to have you on the program. And obviously from our phone response, our listeners have found this quite involving. And our thanks to them for some fine calls tonight as well. The new book by Andrew Ferguson that we've been drawing from is, once again, Land of Lincoln, Adventures in Abe's America.